Good. Somebody plugged it in. As I was preparing for this evening, I thought of the passage in Matthew 21:21. That's one that I know you are all familiar with, where Yeshua said to them, "Truly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, if you say to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, it shall happen." And yet I don't know of one case in the Scriptures or in history where anyone said to any mountain anywhere, be taken up and cast into the sea, and it happened. I don't even know if you're aware of a time when Yeshua did this. So what is he talking about here? Maybe you tried this when you're young in the faith. You went out and tried to get something to get up and walk across and jump in the pond. You know, it's like Yoda in Star Wars, making things. It just doesn't seem to work. Either no one has this kind of faith, or Yeshua is talking about something else altogether. In fact, we do know what he was talking about. I want to quote a rabbi here, Rabbi Bar Yochai. He wrote about Rabbi Abba, and there's a discussion about why is it that sometimes God deals with a situation with strict justice and he brings destruction and brings vengeance and punishment to a certain situation. And other times, he has mercy and doesn't. There's this discussion going on. The rabbis just couldn't, they were talking about this, couldn't come to an agreement on why this was. And Rabbi Abba pipes up and says, many mountains have been uprooted on this question. And he's using a phrase that is found a number of times throughout the Talmud. It was a common phrase in Yeshua's time. And what it had to do with is this. When you come to something that is an apparent conflict in the Scriptures, an inconsistency, if you have faith, and you study and you apply yourself, God will bring a reconciliation. You will see how the two passages do come into agreement with each other. How many people have dismissed the Scriptures altogether because they say, oh, there are too many inconsistencies, too many contradictions, and so their faith was thrown away? And yet we here, sitting here, we have faith in the Word. Because when we come anymore, when I come to something that appears to be a contradiction, I get excited. It's like, okay, this is going to lead me into something deep. And my faith is not broken, but that's when I exercise faith. And I study and I see what others have written about this. And finally I begin to say, oh, now I understand. And that is what is referred to as uprooting the mountain. It's almost as if you're making progress and all of a sudden there's something blocking your way. There's something blocking your way, and by applying the Scriptures, that blockage to your faith is removed. It's cleared away, and you proceed. A common phrase found in the Talmudic and the rabbinic writings, and Yeshua used it himself. He used many of these, many quotes from the rabbinic writings. So, here's the mountain of a problem we want to confront this evening. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless, and the Hebrew word is tohu, and void, and that word is vohu. Or you could say it was chaotic and empty, is another good translation. And darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering, and it goes on and on. Now, if you just read that at face value, you've got a couple ways you can read that. First of all, you can say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and this is how he did it. And you go to verse 2. The earth was formless and void, but then you think, well, wait a minute. How did the earth get there? Now, it doesn't say he made the earth and it was a mess, and so it took him 6 days to fix it. That's not what it says. It doesn't say God turned the lights on and said, oh, mercy me, what is this? I should have done this in the dark. You know, it's going to take me 6 days to fix this thing. So there's a couple ways there you can read this, and neither one is very satisfactory. You see? So if he made the heavens and earth, he created it, but it doesn't tell how this blob of matter with water on it started out. It doesn't tell us that. It tells us what he did with this blob of matter covered with water and darkness. But how did the blob of matter covered with water and darkness get there? Or, when he made the world, he made a big blob of, you know, of chaotic matter covered with water, and then said, okay, now let's take 6 days and turn this into something. Neither one of those is very satisfactory. And yet most rabbis and most Christian commentators try to work with one of those two options. But there are a number of rabbinic commentators and a number of Christian commentators who move mountains. Let's take a look at this other verse, verse 18. For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it. He did not create it a waste place. And the word there is tohu. So, if he created the heavens and the earth there in the beginning, and the earth was tohu, but this comes along and says, no, he didn't make it tohu. You have a mountain. You have two verses that appear to totally contradict one another. And how do you reconcile it? I'm going to suggest a way we can reconcile this. Other people have other ways. So what I'm going to give you is my read on this. And if you disagree, God bless you. You may be right and I may be wrong. But this is where I am. Okay? This is where I am. And since, say, I'm expected to sit up here on the stool and talk to you every Shabbat, you got to listen to my side of things. But, you know, people who take a different view, God bless them, because we're all striving for the same thing. That's to lift up the Word of God, to understand it as best we can. We're not enemies on this, because we all agree this is God's Word. He made the heavens and the earth. We're just trying to figure out how He did it. And so whether we agree or not really doesn't even matter. Okay? But I'm going to give you a read on this that, to me, when my mother explained it to me as a child, strengthened my faith as I went through public school, as I went through university, as I went through a number of graduate classes, and as I'm exposed to the public media and all the bombardment of the same things you are. This has stood with me, and it's kept my faith strong. My mother didn't describe it in the rabbinic detail that I'm going to attempt tonight, but she told it to me in language I can understand. It made perfect sense, and I've never seen any reason to ever adjust it or change it. So, let's begin. I'm going to read to you some passages, and don't worry about writing these down or quoting or recording the sources right now. I'm going to put them on an overhead in a moment. I just want you to listen. We're going to be quoting rabbis from 2,000 years ago on up to about the middle of the 19th century, about 1860, 1850s. So these are all rabbis that precede Darwin's publication of The Origin of Species and the whole evolution deal, okay? And I just want you to listen to what they have to say. So I'll read these, and some of these come from some of the more esoteric sources of rabbinic writings, but they're pretty fascinating. Science is catching up with them. One of the 2,000-year-old sources says, at first, all the powers of the earth were latent and not productive, and the waters were frozen inside it and did not flow. They only spread abroad when a light from above was shed upon the earth, for when this struck it with its rays, its powers were released. This man who wrote 2,000 years ago, Rabbi Ben Yochai, is describing the Ice Age. The waters are all frozen, and then when God allowed light from heaven to come down, they melted. What caused this? He goes on. When the serpent enters the temple of the sea, or the sanctuary in the sea. Now that may sound really strange. He uses in spiritual talk. We're going to find a passage in one of the prophets in a moment where it refers to Satan and his sanctuaries. We don't know much about them. The Bible doesn't tell us much about them. But this source, that's 2,000 years old, refers to Satan having a sanctuary in the sea. I don't understand what that is. Don't worry yourself too much with it. It's what comes after that's interesting. When the serpent enters the temple in the sea, the temple is defiled and its lights are extinguished. Thus the supernal lights leave the sea. Then the waters of the sea split and go to the left side. The sea then freezes and its waters do not flow. Again, a reference to some ancient time before Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, when the earth was frozen. Another passage in this text says, the words, quote, the earth was formless and void, unquote, have already been explained. The word was indicates that it was originally in its ordered state, but now it has become formless, void, and dark. This is written 2,000 years ago. What he is saying is this. That verse that says, and the earth was formless and void, should be translated, the earth became formless and void. Because that Hebrew word was, hayta, is found about 114 times throughout the Hebrew scriptures. And it could be translated was or became. You see, in English, we make this fine differentiation between was and became. But if you was sick, that means you became sick, right? If you was poor, you became poor. And that's why you was poor. You understand? Was and became doesn't make much difference in the Hebraic mindset. In Hebrew, there's no distinction made. So, was and became can be translated either way. We just do it one way or the other in English, because in English we do make these distinctions. But in chapter 1, verse 2, we can go either way. But when we translate it, the earth became formless and void, the mountain is uprooted and cast into the sea. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And how did he create them? What does Isaiah 45 say? He created them not tohu, not chaotic. They were perfect, they were pristine, they were wonderful. And then time passed. Now here's the question, how much time passed? We don't know. But something happened between verse 1 and verse 2. And the earth became formless and void. And darkness was on the face of the waters. Okay? You get the idea? There, I could read more passages from this text that describe the same thing, how the word was should be translated became. Let me read a few other things, though, that are, I think, very interesting. In the book of Rav Hamnuna the Elder, and he lived in the 3rd century, listen to what he wrote. It is explained further that all the inhabited world is circular like a ball, so that some are above and some are below. Further, there is a part of the world that is light, when in another part it is dark, so that some have night while others have day. 3rd century. If only the Roman church in the Middle Ages had read the Hebrew sources and put a little stock in the fact that God had entrusted his oracles to the Jewish people. He doesn't just say it's round, he says it is a ball. And there are people up here and people down here, and one side's dark while the other side's light. That's just incredible. Now, in Job 26, verse 7, this is alluded to, but this is all it says. He, referring to God, stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. I love that. You read all these myths from primitive peoples, and the earth is supported by a turtle, that moves around, or Greek mythology, Atlas holds it on his shoulder. But I haven't read any of the old mythology says it hangs on nothing. Only Job, the oldest book in the Bible, by the way, tells us that the earth is a circle and it hangs on nothing. And then in the 3rd century, Rav Hamnuna comes along and tells us, well, there are people up here and people down here. One side's dark, one side's light, and it's shaped like a ball. Just amazing. Let me go on with a few more. The 1st century book, Sefer HaTamuna, this is written by Rabbi Nahunya ben Hakana. I love these names. Nahunya, come in, time for supper. I just can't imagine. Now, he lived in the 2nd century, I believe, and he speaks about what are called shemitot, sabbatical cycles. Now, most of you who've been here for a while know what a Shemitah year is. The Torah describes that every 7th year, the land is to lay fallow, is to rest. and you eat the harvest that just grows up on its own. Eat the fruit, rather, that grows on its own. And this is called a Shemitah year. Plural of Shemitah, Shemitot. And this Rabbi Nehunya ben Hakana talks about Shemitah sabbatical cycles. This is what he says. He bases it upon the Talmud in Sanhedrin 97a, which says, just as the sabbatical year causes cessation 1 year out of 7 years, every seventh year, work ceases, you rest, you eat the whatever grows up free and wild, so too the world ceases 1 millennium out of 7. Now, we can kind of get the feel from the scriptures that, yes, the world is about, from Adam's time, about 6,000 years. In fact, the Jewish calendar, what is this year? 5769? Is that correct? So 5,769 years since Adam was created. We don't know if that number is accurate, but it's interesting that the Hebrew calendar counts from the year Adam was created, and they've counted 5,769 years. It might be a few more, might be a few less. And we know that there's a millennium coming that will be the millennial kingdom when Yeshua will rule as king in Israel on the throne of David. That's going to be a millennia of rest. And it makes sense. You have 6 days of work, seventh day of rest. You have 7 years of work, then you have the Shemitah year with the land rest. And then you would have 49 years followed by the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, when everyone rests. And so, you know, you can look at the cycle of the feast. You've got seven feasts. And what do you do in the seventh one? Feast of Tabernacles. You sit in this booth, look up at the stars, and you eat, and you enjoy and just sit back and bask in the grace and forgiveness of God. What a wonderful time. So, this rabbi says, well, you know, every seventh millennia would be a millennium of rest. And he bases this, the Talmud bases this, partly on Psalm 90, verse 4, which says, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by. And 2 Peter, in the apostolic scriptures, 2 Peter 3:8, is building on this, and Peter writes, but do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. So, if every seventh day is a Sabbath, a day of rest, why shouldn't every seventh millennia be a millennia of rest? Several of the rabbis of old believe that we are in the seventh such sabbatical cycle. So, not only would this be the seventh millennia, they believe that there have been seven of these complete cycles. And that, therefore, the world was already 42,000 years old when Genesis 1 took place. Okay, do you get the picture? Seven cycles, seven millennia, another seven millennia, seventh one's rest, another seven. And they believe that we are now in the seventh of those. All right? And so the world was 42,000 years old when Adam was created. And you go on up, and we're approaching now the 49th millennia, 49,000 years. Yes, Phil. Yes, that the next one will have no end. Yes, good point. So we're looking for a new heavens and new earth. Isaiah prophesies it, and Revelation John describes it. Yes. And it also makes sense. I wish I looked at the reference. Maybe someone knows it, where Paul talks, I think it's Paul, who talks about us upon whom the end of the ages has come. Now, if you think of, you know, everything started there at Adam and Eve, and Paul lived about 4,000 years later, and there's another 2,000 years since then, and maybe, you know, how does Paul say upon whom the ends of the ages have come? Unless Paul is thinking this way, we know he did. He often quoted information in the Talmud, often did that. So obviously he must believe that there were thousands and thousands and thousands of years before Adam, and he realizes this is the last roundup, and we're approaching the end, just a couple thousand years to go. You see, when you increase the context and put Paul up here towards the end, it really means something when he says, upon whom the ends of the ages are coming. Now, let me go on. There is not universal agreement among the rabbis on the issue of a pre-Adamite earth, but the Sefer HaTamuna states God created universes and destroyed them. Let me move on. Another passage from the Talmud. And the reason I'm giving you these ancient passages is just to fill in some of the blanks so you can understand how many of the writers in the New Testament, how they thought. What was in their mind? What was their context? How did they think about things? You must realize that Christian theology, as we hear it preached today, was not the mindset of those who wrote the Greek scriptures, the apostolic scriptures. It was not their mindset. They were Jews who read the ancient texts, and they thought that way. Now, these ancient texts were simply recording lore and belief and theology that was already old in itself. All right? And if you need some proof that Paul quoted the Talmud and the Midrash and the ancient texts, you need proof of that. Nobody's nodding their heads because you're thinking, oh, he's really going to go on late tonight. Nobody nods yet. I'm going to do it anyway. All right. I'll do it real quick. This is one of my favorites. I'll give you two, in fact. In 2 Timothy, Paul is warning us that in the last days, people will be like the two ancient magicians in Egypt, right? And their names were, what were they? There you go, Jannes and Jambres. Now, how did he know those names? Those names are not recorded in the Bible anywhere. How did he know their names were Jannes and Jambres? Oh, no, I'm looking at 1 Timothy. No wonder I can't find it. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, he talks about the godless generation, how they were always learning, verse 7, but not coming to the knowledge of the truth, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses. Well, you know, when I look at the book of Exodus, I don't see these magicians opposing Moses. They competed with him, and after a couple of the plagues and a couple of the signs, they gave up and they went to Pharaoh and said, this is the finger of God, we can't compete. That doesn't look like opposition to me. And their names are never given in the scriptures except here in 2 Timothy chapter 3. How did Paul know their names? Well, the answer is you go to the ancient Midrash, thousands of years old. And there it records their names, Jannes and Jambres. There they are. And it also tells us that when the mixed multitude came out of Egypt, they got to Mount Sinai, Moses goes up on the mount. It looks like he's delaying. The people are getting restless. Guess who rose up and said, Aaron, let's make a golden calf and worship it so it can lead us back to Egypt? Jannes and Jambres. Now, with that context, you understand what Paul is saying. He's saying, we're in the last days. Our Moses, Yeshua, has ascended. He's told us he's coming back, but it looks like he's late. And there are people out there saying, he's not coming back. Let's live this way. You get it now? Now it makes sense. Another one. This is the other one. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. According to the Talmud, the rock that gave water in the wilderness didn't just give water that one time. It actually rolled through the wilderness the 40 years and continued to provide water throughout the wilderness wanderings. That is not in the Bible anywhere. That's in the ancient rabbinic writings, except here in 1 Corinthians 10. We'll start with verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed to the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food. And get this, verse 4. And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them. And the rock was Messiah. And the reason he says the rock was Messiah is because the letters spell Mashiach can be rearranged to spell the word for flint. And the Torah tells us that the rock was flint. So you rearrange the letters and flint becomes Mashiach. Yes, then.
as far a couple months ago with the next four portion. And the rabbi there during the Torah study was talking about the rock rolling around.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
So they still speak of it today.
Oh, of course, yeah. So I could go on and on and on. Maybe we should take a night sometime and should we do Genesis introduction week 5? No, we better not do that. So I'm doing that to let you know that these ancient texts aren't something we just recently dug up. This is part of the mindset of those who wrote the writings of the New Testament and of Yeshua as well. Yes, Jim, your hand is up. Yes.
Was each time there was a manifestation of anything like this rock, was that Christ himself? And each time was able to see it?
You mean the previous worlds or something? Well, I'm not quite talking about what time you're referring to.
When you see Christ, you know you're looking at Christ.
Yes. Right.
But then each time you would see something else, like this rock itself.
Oh.
Is that Christ?
When Paul says, yeah, that's a great question. Was the rock literally Christ? Was he literally Messiah? No. When Paul says the rock was Messiah, he's using typical Hebraic and even Greek language. When they say, for example, when Yeshua in his parable says, the field is the world. He's saying in this parable, the field represents the world. And so that's what they would do. They say this symbol, this thing that happened, represents this. And they would just say, this is this.
No manifestation of God in something that you could look at and kill
him. Oh, I didn't say that. I'm just saying this is my opinion concerning this rock. No, Messiah, he revealed himself a number of times in the Hebrew scriptures and in the Old Testament in different events. But this rock was simply a picture of him. It pictured something. Okay? All right. Let's move on. Where was I? In one passage in the Talmud, Chagiga 13b suggests that there were 974 generations before the creation of Adam. Now, they arrive at this through Scripture. This is based on Psalm 105, verse 8, which says, he has remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations. And this can also be translated without any stretching or anything this way. The word he commanded at the end of 1,000 generations. But here's the problem. Psalm says he gave his word commanded at the end of 1,000 generations. But it was given in the generation of Moses, and if you do the family tree from Adam, Moses is only 26 generations from Adam. By the way, what 26 rings a bell? What does 26 represent? Yeah, God's personal name, Yod Heh Vav Heh, is 26. So how do you account for these missing 974 generations? Well, Thomas says, well, there must have been 974 generations before Adam was created. The author of Teferet Yisrael, which is a commentary written in the late 17, early 1800s, offers an interesting theory that these 974 generations did exist in a physical sense, but not in fully human form. Now, that's kind of bizarre, and we'll touch on that a little later. Robin. This is my wife. She thinks just like I do. My next point. Rabbi Isaac of Akko, who lived from 1250 to 1350, wrote a book called Otsar HaHaim. In this book, he surmises the following. A divine day equals 1,000 years. Because as it says, 1,000 years or as a day like 1,000 years. So he says the spiritual divine day is 1,000 years long. Therefore, a divine year, and there are 365 and a quarter days in a year, would actually equal 365,250 years. And if there were these 974 or 42,000 years before Adam, as we were going back to that previous passage, he estimated that the age of this planet, the age of the universe, in fact, is 15,340,500,000 years old. Now, he surmised that back in the Middle Ages. If you go to Google, or go to Wikipedia, any of these places, you type in age of the earth. Wikipedia has a wonderful article about this, about how they estimate the age of the earth. They estimate the age of the earth to be 13,730,000 years old, up to 14,700,000, which is pretty close to what this rabbi back in the Middle Ages estimated, 15 billion. In fact, I did a teaching on this a couple years ago, and I printed out the Wikipedia article. I went back this week to see if it had changed, if they had updated it, and they actually had. It's creeping closer to Rabbi Ocko's estimate. Psalm 90, verse 2 states, "Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from world to world, you are God." Now, I just wanted to give you a sampling of some of the ancient rabbinic writings to say there's a whole body of writing and material that would suggest that Genesis 1, verse 2 should be translated, "The earth became formless and void." In other words, God created Adam and Eve exactly the way it describes in Scripture, but on a very, 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 very old planet. One that had possibly seen other creations and destructions. Here, let's summarize some of these people that I've just quoted. Wrong one. Let's summarize these. An ancient concept of an ancient earth. Rabbi Nehunya ben Hakana, first century, is the one who wrote about the existence of prior worlds before this one. By prior worlds, I mean prior kingdoms, races, whatever, creations on this planet. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, 2nd century, is the one who posited the original earth and its destruction, and also wrote about the Ice Age. Rabbi Hamnuna the Elder, in the 3rd century, wrote about the earth being spherical. One side light, one dark, people up here, people down here, walking around. Rabbi Isaac of Akko, 1250 to 1350, estimated the age of the universe at 15,340,500,000 years. And then Rabbi Israel Lipschitz, 1782 to 1860, the existence of man-like creatures in the pre-Adamite earth. He said in these 974 previous generations, they were literal and they were real, but they were not quite human. They weren't quite manlike. No. So can you begin to see that if the earth became formless and void there between verse 1 and 2, you don't see 6 days of creation, you see 6 days of restoration. In fact, from verse 2 on down to about verse 21, you do not see the word create used at all. In verse 1, it says, "Bereshit bara Elohim." In the beginning, God created. And that word bara means to create something out of nothing. And that word's not used again. He says, "Let the seed, let the plants, earth bring forth plants and herbage whose seed is itself upon the earth." Whose seed is already here, it says. Okay, let's look that up. Genesis chapter 1. If you go down to day 3, verse 11, "And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation." Isn't it interesting? It doesn't say he created the plants. Why? The seeds were already there, frozen in the ice. He just simply brought the light and the proper atmospheric conditions where these seeds are already there to begin to spring up. "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit after their kind." and then, as the Hebrew puts it, whose seed is itself upon the earth. The word creed is not used again until we get to the animals, the birds and the fish. Then he had to bara things. He had to start creating them again. And but in between, it's all restoration. We'll look at that more next week as we get deeper to chapter 1. So let's wrap things up here. And let's see what the rest of the scriptures now. Let's limit ourselves to the scriptures alone and see what they tell us. And they can fill in some of the holes that might be in this theory. A possible scenario. First of all, as we said, the earth became formless and void, which is a perfectly sound translation for chapter 1, verse 2. And how do we know this? Because Isaiah 45:18 says God did not create the earth tohu and vohu. He didn't create a tohu, that is. They became this way. Now, Job chapter 9, verses 4 to 7, and Jeremiah 4:23 to 28 seem to be descriptions of a destruction that took place long ago. If you want to turn there, let's start with Job 9, verses 4 to 8. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to offer much commentary at all, just a little bit here or there, because the passages speak for themselves. Now, I have to mention something. When you read prophetic passages, the prophets wrote in a timeless sort of fashion. When they spoke of an event, something good or something bad, what they did was often see other events before or events that were coming after that were the same. And they would describe them all together. Because in the spiritual realm, time doesn't exist. But things that are alike are considered to be the same. It's almost like at different points of time, the same script is being acted out, just on different stages. So you've got this destruction of the earth before verse 2. Then you've got destruction of parts of Israel. They're a lot like that destruction there. So God just describes them together. You've got destruction coming in the future at the Armageddon. And when the earth and the heavens are rolled up like a scroll, you see destructions coming. So God sees destruction. And he describes destruction. But he dropped these little hints in to point to things in the past, sometimes to point to things in the future. But you have to remember that in prophecy, it's timeless. Here you have spiritual truths coming from a realm where time does not exist. And it's like the script is written, and now it's being acted out again at a different stage. Now the script's being acted out over on this stage at a different point in time. Can you kind of follow what I'm trying to allude to? Job 9, verses 4 to 8. Wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has defied him without harm? It is God who removes the mountains. They know not how. When he overturns them in his anger. Now, when in the world did God ever remove mountains literally and overturn them? Turning mountains upside down? Now, he talks about shaking the earth later. But the scientists wonder, why do we find cities at the bottom of the ocean? We find fossils of seashells on tops of mountains. I mean, we don't have anything in human history where there are eyewitnesses to something like this happening. We can see the geological evidence that it happened. But something this catastrophic has not been experienced during human history. Now, back in the flood, that seems to be very similar. Who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. Who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars. Who alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the sea. Jeremiah 4, verses 23-28. This is a little more specific. I looked on the earth and behold, it was tohu and vohu. It was formless and void. And to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and behold, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. I looked, and behold, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens had fled. So there had been some man, and there had been birds, but now they were gone. I looked, and behold, the fruitful land was a midbar, a wilderness. That word Midbar comes up a little bit later, so I just want you to make a note of that. And all its cities were pulled down before the Lord, before his fierce anger. For thus says the Lord, the whole land shall be desolate. Yet I will not execute a complete destruction, but form to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. For this earth shall mourn, and the heavens above be dark, because I have spoken. I have purposed, and I will not change my mind, nor will I turn from it. Now we back up a little bit to the verses right before verse 23. We're given some reason why this destruction took place. Verses 20 to 22 say disaster on disaster is proclaimed. She gets that double disaster on top of disaster. For the whole land is devastated. Suddenly my tents are devastated, my curtains in an instant. How long must I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? For my people are foolish. They know me not. They are stupid children, and they have no understanding. They are shrewd to do evil, but to do good they do not know. And this has been suggested by a number of commentators as describing something that took place before Adam was even created, something in the ancient, ancient past. Yes, Rosemary. Exactly. The only thing, the problem is, it says that it became tohu and vohu here. And that word, that's the language of Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. Yeah, but here it says that the earth became a wilderness, and we're going to see later who did that, and that it was tohu and vohu. If the language is pointing back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. That's the event it's referring to. Well, let's go. We can talk about this later. I want to get through this because I don't want people mad at you and me for going over too much. All right? So we'll talk about this later. Let's move on to this right now. Ezekiel 28, verses 12 to 19, give us a possibility of why this happened. Why did this, whatever these people were, these things that lived before Genesis 1, 2, why things all went belly up, so to speak. Ezekiel 28:12. Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre. What's interesting, we have no historical record of a king of Tyre. And say to him, thus says the Lord God, you had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Who's he describing here? Universally, this is understood as referring to Satan. Every precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the lapis lazuli, the turquoise and emerald. This is sometimes thought, this is why the high priest bore the names of Israel, these precious stones on his chest, on the ephod. Because somehow the ministry of Satan was taken away from him and it was given to man. Every precious stone was your covering. I read that part. And the gold, the workmanship of your settings and sockets. What were the stones set in on the high priest? Breastplate? Gold. That was in you. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. You were the anointed cherub who covers. This is an angel, a cherub. And I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. By the abundance of your trade, you were internally filled with violence, and you sinned. Therefore, I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God. Does this remind you of some of the language you find in Revelation, like in chapter 12 and other places? And I have destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. Important life principle here. Pride makes you stupid. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. You think you're hot stuff? You're on your way to Stupidville. humility makes you wise. Humility makes you wise. Pride makes you dumb as dirt. It made Satan the wisest, the most beautiful, most brilliant of God's creation, made him the lowest. And humility can make the lowest lifted up. Humble yourself in the eyes of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Due time. Humility takes you that way, and pride takes you that way. Pride goes before a fall. I mean, it's just a rule of the universe. But let's move on. I cast you to the ground. I put you before kings that they may see you. By the multitude of your iniquities and the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries, your temples. Remember the passage we read from the rabbinic work earlier? The serpent comes to the sanctuary, but he brings darkness to it. He pollutes it. It would seem so. We can't say exactly when, but it seems it would have to be before chapter 1, verse 2 of Genesis. It has to be somewhere there. Therefore, I have brought fire from the midst of you. It has consumed you, and I have turned you to ashes on the earth in the eyes of all who see you. All who know you among the peoples are appalled at you. You have become terrified, and you will be no more. And Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 20, is a sister passage to this. Isaiah 14, starting with verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven. And some translates say Lucifer, but it should be, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Interesting study you can do. These five things that Satan claims he's going to do are five things he never accomplished. But if you look into the New Testament, you'll find these are five things that God freely gives to his children. Don't you know that just really gripes Satan? Oh, it's got to make him mad. Oh, well, too bad. We go on to verse 15. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a midbar? There's the same word used back in the Jeremiah passage, where it says, they were looked, and behold, the earth was tohu and vohu. And then went on to say, and the land was a midbar. And this is where it tells us about how Satan made the world a midbar, a wilderness, and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home. All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. Clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial, because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Interesting passages. And do they all apply to this pre-Adamite earth? It certainly seems so, and people smarter than me claim that they do. But when you look at it this way, the picture becomes pretty simple. And you take science, and whatever those scientists want to talk about, let them talk. It doesn't shake our faith. Let's look at the timeline. In the beginning, we'll put the beginning way over there somewhere, God created heavens and the earth. And time passed and passed and passed. Maybe millions, maybe billions, maybe thousands. I don't know. I really don't care a whole lot how much time passed. But during that time, there were plants. There were animals. Some kind of ape-like people. I don't know. I don't care. Dinosaurs, absolutely. And we do see that multi-celled creatures look like they evolved from single-celled creatures. Because as you dig down deep, you find single-celled creatures, and as you go up, you find more and more complex creatures. So maybe there's some kind of evolution that took place back there. I don't care what happened back there. I just know it was back there. And then you come to verse 2, and the earth became formless and void. Ice age hits. It's like the lights went out, everything froze, Everything died. We find these up in Siberia, find these mammoths who are frozen in mid-stride with food in their mouths that they're chewing. Boom! Everything just dies. Now the seeds are still there. They're still fine. And we don't know how much time passed after that. But then we come to verse 3 of Genesis. God turns the lights back on. It begins to separate the darkness and the light, the waters above from below, the dry land from the seas. And then all of a sudden the vegetation just springs up on its own. And then he creates fish and birds and the animals. And then out of this dust, he forms man and says, let us make man in our image. And breathes into his nostrils the neshama of life. And he plants a garden to the east in Eden and puts man there that he created. So here's Adam showing up on the stage of this ancient planet that apparently was under Satan's jurisdiction. But Satan blew it. He was demoted. And God said, I'm really going to make Satan mad. I'm going to pour my love and my grace upon these people that contain my soul, but their bodies are made out of dirt. I'm going to give them dominion. And then who comes slinking into the garden to try to turn the whole thing back upside down? Does that, you see how it, I let the scientists say what they will. It doesn't affect the scriptures. They stand. Now, is this theory correct and exact and perfect? I don't know. But it's one that stands up. It's one that you can't just say, impossible. Because it does fit. It fits the evidence of science. It nowhere in any way violates the scriptures. If it violated the scriptures in one iota, then I would have to reject it, but it doesn't. It fits like a hand in the glove of the scriptures. And I think it takes and uproots a mountain that has destroyed the faith of many. Phil. Yes, absolutely. New heaven and new earth. It is. Right. It's incredible. God always spirals things up. You remind me of a passage. We'll close with this because we've gone over. You remind me of a passage. I was reading through this physics book. You're really bored when you start reading through physics books, I know. But this is kind of a fun physics book. And it was talking about entropy. How many of you know what entropy is? Okay, entropy is for those of you who don't know, is the tendency of everything in the universe to wind down. Now, some things start at a high, it's like children, they start out life at a high level of energy and they wind down, they get like me. And cars come off the assembly line beautiful, and after a while they begin to rust, the paint fades and things. Everything winds down. You put a pot of hot water on the table, it'll cool down to room temperature. The energy just kind of leaks out of things. And this physics book was talking about entropy, and it's like, yeah. And he says, but there's one exception. And this is what they called it. The one exception to entropy is life. They can't explain life. Because life spirals up. Acorns become oak trees, and those acorns become a forest, you see? And fish and animals multiply and become more fish and animals. Life goes the other direction. And that's just so incredible. That's our God. You reminded me of that, Phil. That He is the way, the truth, and the life. And that's why we're not to lay up treasures on earth where moth and rust corrupt and thieves break through and steal and entropy just winds them down. But you lay up yourself treasures in heaven. Because, boy, it just spirals up. You can't beat it. Choose life, Moses commands us. Let's close with that. And if you want to talk about these things more, I'll be I'll be up here hiding under the piano. Father, thank you for this time together, for your word. And Lord, I just pray you continue to give us wisdom and insight. Don't allow us to embrace and believe things that are in error. But Father, I pray you give us clarity and Lord, do things that strengthen